Welcome, everybody, to the third and final keynote of this year's conference, the Graham Davis Keynote Lecture, named after and in honor of one of the founding fathers of Eurocall and the first president of the association. It is with enormous pleasure that I welcome Professor Mark Brown, the director of the National Institute for Digital Learning at Dublin City University, to give the Graham Davis keynote lecture. I had to promise Mark not to mention or list any of his outstanding achievements as a scholar, and to send you straight to his online staff profile at Dublin City University. I am allowed to tell you that Mark is originally from New Zealand, and that his real name is not Mark Brown. The challenge for you between now and the closing ceremony tomorrow is to find out what his real name is, and buying Mark a few drinks, he says, will help you to get to the bottom of the secret. Now, to future-proof anything, including call, Mark feels very strongly that we need to start with the past, and that we also need to problematize the future. And this is what he's going to do over the next 45 minutes with us here. And with this, I hand you over to Mark and the Monsters.
Thank you very much. Tenakoto, tenakoto, tenakoto katoa. I've just given you a traditional greeting in the country of my birth, New Zealand, in the Māori language. Thank you for the kind introduction, and we'll see how well you get on in finding my real name. Very few people know that. I can count them on one hand. In this talk this afternoon, I want to really build on the two previous excellent keynote speakers. And I want to address directly the conference theme, the concept of future-proofing. As you can see, I've adopted a rather provocative, or hopefully interesting, sort of title. And the first thing I want to do is introduce you to the very first monster. Now, there are going to be a number of monsters through this talk, but here is the first monster. This is me. When I was born, well, shortly after I was born, truthfully. And if you want to tweet, well, you can see my handle there as well. The first thing I want to do, though, before I really get started, is engage you in a little participation, because you've just come back from lunch, the post-lunch dip, and I want to introduce you to an amazing new piece of technology. It comes in a box as simple as this. It's a whole new area of development in technology and educational technology, only starting to be used, second time I've piloted it, and it's around the area of telepresence. So what I have for you, you're probably familiar with where you are asked to poll with your cell phone or maybe with your laptop. Telepresence uses a completely new technology, quite mind-blowing technology in some respects, because it's a mind poll. Now, I know you've only just sat down and some of you are busy answering your emails, but I'm going to ask you to indulge me for no more than about 30 seconds, and everyone stand up unless you have a disability, please. So, the first thing I need is to clear your mind of any clutter. So I'm going to show you something on the screen, and I just want you to focus on it for about 5 seconds, just to clear your mind from whatever you've been doing prior to coming in here. So just take a look at this. Right. Now I'm going to ask you a simple question. And all you have to do is think of the answer, and the moment you've thought of the answer, you're able to sit down. So here's the question. If you thought of it, sit down, because you might corrupt the poll. Okay. You're allowed to, in polls, not vote and sit on the fence if you like. Otherwise, we could have you standing here for the whole time for the rest. But take your own time. Let's just see. I will now just do something here. Right. Let's see what comes through. 1945. Think not. What? Clearly someone had not cleared their mind at the start. Okay, whoops, we'll go back. Well, if you believe what I just did then, you'll believe anything. Second monster. There's a lot of snake oil merchants in the field of educational technology selling their wares, and we need to be very critical and have our antennae sharply tuned for these snake oil merchants. Of course, the exercise also demonstrates the power of the teacher, does it not? Look what I got you to do, with a handful of people who weren't quite sure whether they wanted to play along with this or not. Anyway, I guess I should give the special device here to my chair.
Oh, thank you.
There you go. So, back to the real answer, 1962. You see, I'm not vain in any way. I'm not wearing makeup, thanks to those of you who said 1970-something. Here I am in 1962 with my two elder brothers. I was brought up in an age in a very remote part of New Zealand where I had no radio and no television until my early teens. And there may be, I see a few people just shaking or nodding, they might be of the same vintage as me. I could ask you to stand up if you were born in 1962, I hadn't thought of that. And I had the somewhat unusual experience to also be brought up for most of my early years living right next to the small country school. And so I've got a little arrow just how close that's the school. Just three-teacher school. Actually, my mother was a teacher's aide and semi-teacher. So what happened, and I've got three confessions woven throughout this presentation. My mother, when I was born, she was, I guess, ahead of her time because she didn't take maternity leave. Many of you, I hope, know about New Zealand's Prime Minister who's just come back from maternity leave. But she didn't take maternity leave because she continued working and she got the senior girls, they were girls in this case, so maybe she wasn't entirely ahead of her time, to pop over to see if I was still asleep. Now, I'm told that I used to sleep about 18 hours a day. And they would pop over at what we in New Zealand would call playtime, perhaps recess or the breaks and then lunchtime. And typically I slept most of the time. Apparently I wasn't that much of a monster back then. The only thing I have to tell you, first confession, is that I'm largely with the exception of a little bit of Indigenous Māori language, monolingual, which therefore makes me feel very much of a fraud in a conference like this. But also, I was very slow in developing as a baby. Surprise, surprise. Quite slow in learning to speak and walk. And in fact, before I went to school, had to have speech language therapy. So I have a lot to blame my mother on, as most of us do, men, that is, in particular. So that's a little bit of my background there, but I managed to get to school in the end, and there I am in the early, I think I might be in the first year or second year, sitting there in the front row. That's the whole school. And then anyone that knows anything about New Zealand will know that we are a great sporting nation. But sadly, there's really only one sport that matters. It's a sport known as rugby. And in my time, we had no option, but we had to play rugby. Boys, girls most definitely couldn't play rugby. They had to play netball. So there I am, and the best way to describe my rugby playing abilities would be that I wasn't the fullback. I wasn't a wing. I'm probably best described in the position in the game as drawback. There isn't a position called drawback. No one chose me when they were working out who wanted to go on which team. So therefore, whilst I may have aspired to be a mighty All Black world champions at rugby several times over, there was no way I was going to ever be an All Black. But I well remember my very first achievement at school. Here it is. Hopefully you can see this. The Principal's Award for, can you see it? General helpfulness. The kind of thing you get when they can't think of anything else to give you. The General Helpfulness Award. This is my first ever achievement. There's another part to this story in that if you look really closely, it's signed by L.L. Brown, who happens to be the man there, because what I didn't tell you previously, the reason we lived next to the school was because my father was the principal and signed this. So I wasn't a great scholar. I remember getting the strap many times from my principal dad. Heaven forbid those days, how things have changed. But then I went off to go to secondary school in another city, and I had to go to a city to go to secondary school, and I had to live in that city as a boarder. And so I was wished a bright future in my final school report. Well, that kind of didn't play out that well either, because in 1978, I was well and truly corrupted. Some people call this kind of video games like cocaine for the brain, by the invention of the Casio Space Invaders calculator. Does anyone remember this?
Yes.
Right? Well, I spent my entire time in maths playing the calculator or the game when people thought I was doing maths, but I clocked this, and it certainly didn't help with my academic achievement. Moving on, as you can see, I had a lot more hair back then. Here I am towards the senior years of my schooling. No one in my family had ever been to university, I might add as well, which is very important for me, the power and transformative potential that education has. But nonetheless, in 1980, I continued to be corrupted because that was the year when Pac-Man was invented. So again, I see a few people shaking their heads there. They're of the same vintage. Not everyone here. Some of this will be something that happened before you were born. But I spent a lot of my time on Pac-Man to the expense of my final year of schooling. I also discovered then another part of what it means to be an adolescent, a teenager. So in 1980, I spent a lot of my time outside of school, perhaps during school time as well, dancing a gig to David Bowie's. In this instance, we have no sound. Whoever is on our sound, we might just pause that for a minute. It's probably just the source that we had to change. We are going to get something beyond story soon, I promise. Substance, I think it's called.
Back with this.
Just go to that one. It was the source that we had to change to get it working before lunch.
Yes.
I wouldn't worry too much other than the fact I have a couple of other videos to come, and these ones are more crucial than this one happens to be. So you're just going to find someone? Okay, I'll skip through this one. And we had a little test before lunch and found that we needed to change the source, and it worked fine. I'll let you have a little bit of the visuals, because this is a lesser-known David Bowie song, and in the context of the title of this keynote, actually quite important, Scary Monsters and Super Creeps. I thought this would be a video with the audio that goes with it that would kind of wake you up a little bit, even more than that standing up exercise. Okay, in the interest of time, and hopefully we can get the... There was just one thing, simple thing, which was to click from the source, to change the source. 1981, almost finished the story, apologies for the little interjection there, one other thing came along. Not only was I dancing a jig to David Bowie at that time, but I was also somewhat infatuated, I think might be the word, as a young teenager. I'm kind of slightly embarrassed to say, because this kind of is a bit sexist in today's age, but Miss Venezuela happened to win two Miss Venezuelas, Miss World and Miss Universe in 1981. It's true, you can look it up on Google, it has to be true. And so my life plans changed then. And so what happened is that I spent a lot of my hard-earned money to purchase Spanish tapes. Now, I said that I had three confessions to give to you. This is number two confession. Not only am I monolingual largely, but I was a dismal failure at trying to learn Spanish on this system, even though it cost me a lot of money. I managed to sell them for about a quarter of the price. So, planning my trip to South America, one last thing came along, and that is that I had an opportunity as an 18/19-year-old to buy a house of all my savings for my big trip. This is the house, and you know, the head ruled the heart. And I often wonder, when after I purchased that house, and I only went to Colombia a couple of weeks ago, I wonder what my life might have been had I gone off to South America as an 18 and 19-year-old. I doubt I would have ever come back, quite frankly. So what is the point of taking all this valuable time to tell you this little story? Well, you know, in my life, and I think, I hope that I've made some connections with your upbringings, regardless of your age, who could have predicted the changes that have taken place? The more the future, I guess, changes, the more it stays the same in one respect, but on the other hand, the future isn't what it ain't. What used to be. And in, if you like, in my case, when I grew up as that baby in a small country area with no television, no radio, who could have thought I'd be doing the job I am now at Dublin City University as director of the National Institute for Digital Learning, especially if they saw my academic background. And to even, this is embedded advertising here, I think it's called, even to be the chair next year of the World Conference on Online Learning in Dublin, which we hope to see many of you at, because it happens to coincide with the Bram Stoker Festival, the author of Dracula. Okay, I promised you that there might be a bit of substance along the way here. Story, done. I have three parts that I want to explore in the time we have available. We'll see how we get on in covering the whole lot. I'm actually quite relaxed if I don't finish the whole lot because my slides are on SlideShare and you can kind of figure out what else I had to say, but we'll see. Monster predictions, revealing more of the monsters, and then I want to adopt the language of opportunity rather than the pedagogy of the depressed in the context of new technologies and monsters, and talk about how we might reimagine monstrous futures. If I do run out of time, I've kind of linked this talk into the work of Elvin Toffler, and some of this work resonates still today, although I'm taking a very loose interpretation, and in particular from the book Future Shock, since we're talking about future-proofing. This quote here, all education springs from images of the future, and all education creates images of the future. Thus, all education, whether or not so intended, is a preparation for the future. Unless we understand the future for which we're preparing, we may do tragic damage to those we teach. So that's kind of the central message, if I happen to kind of run out of time and distract you with lots of other things. And the other thing I think I also need to put a health warning on is, this is probably my all-time favourite quote, all generalisations are dangerous, including this one. And when you start hearing sweeping generalisations, and there are probably a few of them woven throughout my talk, your critical antennae should go off. So just bear that in mind. All generalisations are dangerous. So let's get started. Monster predictions. You know, predictions about the future and the impact new technology will have on our societies and education more specifically are not new. And I have to be very careful. I typically don't use this particular slide now based in Dublin, but I think I'm okay here. The farther backward you can look the farther forward, you can see into the future. So I'm kind of working off this premise. So we don't have to look too far back in the future here, because here's a quote that's talking about the early days, just when the World Wide Web, some of you may remember, even browsers like Mozilla were starting to make the internet something that was much more hypertext or hypermedia based. This kind of automatic library at the pressing of a button. Well, actually, that wasn't 1984, it was 1894. Referring to the invention and the impact of the wax phonograph cylinder. And I'm sure that you've come across the following quotes from many other keynotes. I'm usually a bit embarrassed using them, but they help tell the tale. I'm sure you've seen this one previously about the impact the textbook would have, the motion picture on the textbook, and then television, the impact that television was going to have. If you can see really carefully, I'm not sure if it comes through, but it even refers to blackboard back then, and you know how our thinking hasn't changed when we still use metaphors like blackboards in the digital age. And then I think this has been referred to more than once over the course of the conference, but for those of you who aren't old enough to remember this, this was really the major first initiative with computers, with mainframe computers for educational purposes, Project Plato. Let's see how this plays. Are we good on video?
Hopefully.
Good. Oops. Well, how wrong he got it. On the one hand, because you know what? That kind of thinking hasn't gone away, both in a pedagogical sense, but also in the design of new technology. And many of the claims we're hearing about AI currently actually mirror many of the claims that were made about some of these previous technologies. Way back in 1986, Larry Cuban published this very short little book that traced the history of these instructional or educational technologies. And it has to be judged, this book, for the time in which it was published. But he talked about the technology expectation cycle that all new technologies in education go through. The first part begins with these bold predictions, big claims about how the technology would transform education. Then the period of growing support, people, early adopters trying out the technology, early pilot projects and so forth. The third phase being then when, didn't quite work the way the prediction suggested, and the subsided enthusiasm, people kind of realising, it's more complex than perhaps we were told. And then the final phase he identifies, perhaps the most important, is the period of rebukes and blame. And of course, who gets the blame? The teachers, the instructors. Despite the fact that maybe there was never enough money in the first place, that the infrastructure wasn't there, that the leadership didn't really understand what was trying to be achieved, there were no policies or strategies, so on and so forth. Having said that, I think since we're a group of educators here, we're not divorced from some of the blame. I wouldn't normally adopt that deficit kind of language. But let's just have a look at, in our profession, how different mindsets impact on the successful adoption of any new innovation, whether that's a technology innovation or otherwise. The one thing we know from 70 years of research in the field of what I'll call educational technologies, is that the single most important factor is the teacher. And the teacher's mindset, their orientation, pedagogically speaking, mediates the way in which the technology is adopted. No two teachers will necessarily adopt the technology in the same way. One who has a particular view of learning, more instructionalist, is going to use the technology in a very different way from someone with a different kind of outlook on teaching and learning. It's a very simple analysis of the literature, but that's a consistent finding. And if we want to go a little further, this is not well grounded empirically, but it's a useful framework. In any educational context, whether it be a school or a university, an institute of technology, or similar, you'll have these different viewpoints or mindsets, as I have used. You've got the boosters. These are the people who are champions of the new technology. Usually they turn the mainstream off. Then you have the de-schoolers who see this technology as a way of fundamentally changing the power relationships of an educational institution, the way the curriculum is. And so the technology can be very subversive here. So they're very supportive of technology for different reasons than the boosters. Then you have the doomsters, and I'm sure you know some of these amongst your colleagues. They're most definitely not typically at conferences like this, but they exist. And they kind of have this sense in which this technology, this technological nightmare, and they adopt a very socially deterministic view of the world as distinct from the technologically deterministic and technocentric view from their other colleagues, the boosters and de-schoolers. By far, and this is reasonably empirically grounded, certainly in my own research, the largest group in education are the toolsters. It's just the tool and it's how you use it that makes the difference. That's what I was just saying before, wasn't it? That's a dangerous view. Actually, yesterday our keynote made this very point, because the risk of the toolster perspective is, yes, we use the tool, but as we're using the tool also uses us. And there's even evidence to show how the human hand evolved differently because of the way in which we adopted tools. So there's not a one-dimensional relationship. And I'm going to unpack that a little further. So that's just a framework to be thinking about. And if you want to add a bit more theory wrapped around it, I won't talk about these because I don't really have time. But those are mindsets that exist from a educational change perspective. And if you remember, our first keynote very much was talking about educational change. So these are the realities and the complexities of change just in the microcosm or ecology of a school or university environment. What I would advocate is we all need to become more critics, be able to understand these different perspectives, understand their positions, because if you really want to be successful, if you don't win over the doomsters, actually, win over is not the right language. If you don't get into their minds and their hearts, then you're almost doomed to fail in any large-scale innovation. Then at a pedagogical level, I referred to previously about the different mindsets. It's fair to say that we know that many of our colleagues, despite what we understand about contemporary learning theory, still have their pedagogical compass somehow stuck, pointing towards learning by listening, or actually precisely what I'm doing right now, teaching by telling. When in fact a rich learning environment, and I try to put my work into lay language here quite deliberately, even though there are quite deep and well-developed theories behind these concepts, a pedagogical compass really needs to swing between all of these perspectives. Quoting the work of Svard from 1998 about the two root metaphors of learning, the acquisition metaphor and the participation metaphor, they are not mutually exclusive. Ultimately, putting aside the role that teachers play in the success or not, what we know from the history of new technologies in education is, yes, they go through this hype, hope, and then largely disappointment cycle. Some people have kind of put this and made the connection with the Gartner hype cycle, and I'm sure many of you have come across this. It's very popular in talks. I really hate this with a passion because it's inherently technocentric. The focus is on the technology. It completely ignores the importance of the context in which a technology is adopted, and I've already pointed out at a pedagogical level the different factors that can come into play. And then the focus here is actually on resistance to adoption, whereas I try to anchor my work more in what I'll describe as an ecological perspective, where from an ecology view of the world, resilience, not resistance, is where we should be placing our focus. Not resistance to change, but resilience. And even this room here that I'm talking right now in, you might consider hasn't changed from a 19th century lecture theatre. Actually, it has. It's fundamentally different. We've got this battleship podium here. So in resilience, what has happened is the deep and complex ecology has evolved over time to take on the affordances and dismiss others in a way that we don't necessarily see, not on a day-to-day basis. But we have most definitely changed our practice for better and worse. But the focus here is understanding the complexity of the interrelations from a change perspective. And of course, if you don't change when conditions change in an ecology like the New Zealand moa, it becomes extinct. Of course, some people are saying teaching and learning is doomed in large institutions like universities. If you take this perspective, actually it also encourages you to innovate, because by innovating, you're positioning yourself to evolve for what comes next. You're more predisposed for adaptation, if you like. Partly the new ecology, if I extend this, looks a bit like this. Now what we've got, and in some respects this is where the technology has had an impact, this kind of digital leakage between these four quadrants or spaces of learning. And what we've tended to do for a long period, just remember I just made a sweeping generalisation just for your antennae to go off, what we've tended to do is place our emphasis on that blue circle, on campus or in school, on site. Whereas now we know that, of course, when you're designing for learning, you actually need to think about all four of those quadrants quite intentionally, even if it's with the intention not to design for one of them. But that's part of the new ecology that we operate within. Of course, again, sweeping generalisation, supported by a reasonable amount of evidence when it comes to the VLE or the LMS, the learning management system, but even in environments like this, that in that blue circle, a lot of what we do is still stuck in the kind of swamp. It's not as invigorating and enriching and dynamic as we might want it to be for our learners. That's kind of the norm more than the exception. Of course, it's also a breeding ground for all sorts of other organisms and insects and the like. Lesson number one. I'm very conscious of time, anyone watching me here, so we'll speed up a little, but the lesson here is culture eats strategy for lunch. This is kind of an extension of ecology, that if you don't have the right kind of culture, the conditions, then any change is doomed to fail. You might have the wonderful documents, the strategies, the plans. I'm often asked to advise people and institutions on how they develop a digital learning strategy. My first comment is don't. You have a teaching and learning one, but if you haven't got the right kind of organisational culture, the subcultures, the culture at your school level or department level, that's the most important place to be focused on. So that was lesson number one. We'll speed up a bit now. Revealing the monsters. I've revealed some, but there are some more scary monsters. I guess I won't read this quote, you can read as I'm talking, but the point of this quote here is that all education is political, and I think that was one of the takeaway messages from yesterday's keynote as well. All education is political, and when we start talking about the future, that's a political conversation. So anchored in that sort of thinking, or framing it within that, one of the other monsters we have now is the MOOC. And the MOOC tends to polarise people. You either love them or hate them, and there are, I find few people in the middle. In the US, of course, MOOCs kind of like yesterday's history. In Europe, MOOCs are huge still for different reasons, and there's been research documenting why those reasons are different. Fundamentally different drivers between the US and Europe. That's not a generalisation, but it's well anchored in research. Regardless of what you think about the MOOC, last year, on this evidence, around 80 million learners registered for a MOOC. And if you include non-English-speaking platforms like those in India and China, using George Siemens as a reference here, he estimates about 130 million registered learners in MOOCs. So MOOCs have not gone away. MOOCs are not yesterday's news. And if you take that ecological view of change here, MOOCs are having quite an impact on education, higher education more than K-12. Quite an impact. These next couple of slides, I'm a bit hesitant to choose, given that my the chair of the session is a staff member at the UK Open University. But what MOOCs have been used for is, of course, to bring language to learners in a way that they may not have had the opportunities previously. I say a little uncomfortable because when this initiative first happened and was celebrated at the time as the biggest ever MOOC, 400 plus learners learning English, I kind of thought, coming from a colonised country, this smacks of neo-colonialism here. And then to take the political dimension of education one step further, I felt very uncomfortable when the Vice-Chancellor, who's now left the UK Open University, so I'm probably on safer grounds, tweeted and celebrated the size of this MOOC: UK MOOC snatches world record for sign-ups, UK quality beating US money or dollars. And so for me, that's very much a reflection of the new higher education marketplace that's been created, and new technologies are core to those. In our own case at Dublin City University, we've been a relatively late starter on MOOCs. And the very first MOOC, and we are a partner of FutureLearn, so I've just taken a little shot at FutureLearn, but we're a partner of FutureLearn, very closely with them. But deliberately, our very first MOOC, launched in January, was on the Irish language and culture. And since that launch, we've had over 20,000 registrations, and it's the second highest level of engagement of a FutureLearn course in Irish 101. We're up to Irish 105 coming out shortly. It was very important for us that this was the first MOOC. The drivers for our initiative in using MOOCs at DCU are completely different than most institutions. I was not going to write anything and support anything that said MOOCs were about profiling DCU to the world. So we have deliberately adopted MOOCs as a play space, an ecology for trialing out new ideas, new innovations in teaching and learning, a space to do that. Cultivate new ideas so that we can take those into the mainstream. And I think an important difference, I really enjoyed our first keynote, but an important difference that maybe wasn't quite amplified is that means that we also embrace failure, because failure is where you learn from. And in our case with our MOOC initiative and FutureLearn, we had several dismal failures that got us to this place. We wouldn't be where we are now had we not piloted, be the first university in the world, to pilot the MOOC Academy platform, Academy platform. And then we found it just didn't work. So failure is a really important aspect, and then fail again as part of innovation. So the new kind of world that we live in, I guess, is a kind of a reality. I don't want to be too technologically deterministic, but we're trying to use MOOCs as a way, putting aside bringing the Irish language and other areas of knowledge to a wider group of learners, as a place to see how we can do things differently for the new reality of the kind of mobile learner of the future. Now, of course, there are a number of people that try to speculate and predict what the future in learning teaching might look like. If you haven't seen this report published back in May by EY, EY is the rebranded Ernst Young, the accountancy firm, if you like, worldwide. So you kind of your antennae should be going off and asking how come they're involved in producing documents about the future of higher education. They come up with these four different scenarios for universities of the future. These are not that different from other documents that have looked at scenarios for the future. But to put a bit of flesh on this, what the future might really look like, have a look at this video, fingers crossed, of the prediction what of education will look like in the year 2026. I hope you find it quite scary, because I do. Don't need to move the mouse. This one I do want to be able to show you. Good.
Each edumach represents 1 hour of learning in a particular subject. Anyone can grant edumachs to anyone else. You can earn edumachs from a formal institution like a school or your workplace. But you can also earn them from individuals or informal groups like a community center or an app. The ledger makes it possible for you to get credit for learning that happens anywhere, even when you're just doing the things you love. Your profile displays all the edublocks you've earned. Employers can use this information to offer you a job or a gig that matches your skills. We'll keep track of all the income your skills generate and use that data to provide feedback on your teachers. When you're choosing a teacher in the future, you may wish to choose the teacher whose students are earning the most income. You can also use the ledger to find investors in your education. Since the ledger is already tracking income earned from each edublock, you can offer investors a percentage of your future income in exchange for free learning hours. Our smart contracts make these agreements easy to manage and administer. The ledger is built on.
I'll stop on that note. Apologies, I didn't want to interrupt the video to get the audio a bit higher, so I hope you were able to just follow it there. Of course, I guess in countries in Europe where education remains largely free, that idea of being able to put yourself out to investors for your education doesn't work. In my case, I would have been a great investment because I had a crap school record and I've probably now given them way good return. But this thinking exists. You know, these videos don't come out of nowhere. And so, in many respects, this is kind of like the new global neoliberal higher education supermarket, where the learner, and this is not popular language because we generally say we want the learner to be in control of their learning, to take responsibility, where the learner picks a bit of this and a learner takes a bit of that, and they put these together in some kind of new badge or some credential across institutions and the like. Now, this thinking can be interpreted in very different ways, as I'll show you shortly. And ultimately, what I think the lesson here is that we need to be very wary of publications like this, where different interest groups and stakeholders are using the same language of persuasion, but for very different agenda. And I need to kind of unpack this, but I'm going to have to do it quickly because I've got an eye on the time. And if you want to kind of go a little further, if you haven't come across Audrey Waters' work, she's published a couple of online books and has a very high-followed blog. But having said that, I'm not entirely taken of Audrey's work because I mentioned about the pedagogy of the depressed. I like to position myself more in the language of opportunity. Nonetheless, Einstein once said it's theory that decides what we observe, that helps us to see. So let's use a bit of theory here. What theory might we use? And I'm sure you've had some of these theories come up over the last couple of days. I quite like, activity theory. I could draw on, probably because of the political dimension here, actor network theory at the heart of it, understands that all education's political. But you know, I'm just going to use 101 sociology with you. Keep life simple. Two worldviews. Here's the first one. Where this language is used in these competing views of the future. First, the worldview of the knowledge economy. And here's probably the very best example, without wanting to offend anyone, of what I mean by a perspective that's enshrined within or imbued with the language of the knowledge economy. I call it competition, the American way. Here, education is a private good, not a public good, where the individual invests in their education. Not dissimilar to the video that you just saw, that comes out of the US. The alternative view, and of course, the world doesn't quite work this simply, but really has its roots in this part of the world, to be quite honest, particularly in the Scandinavian countries, in Europe, the knowledge society or the learning society view. Here's a contrast of what the role of education might be, using the words of President Higgins from Ireland. And hopefully you can see that, but the key words, that the emphasis there on the big challenges, the grand challenges facing us in the future. Couldn't be more different perspectives here education is a public good. Actually, I would argue humanity depends on a perspective in which we understand the public good of education. You could get more complex, and sometimes I write about these different viewpoints underneath these to help unpack, and I'll just use one example under the perspective of de-schooling that I referred to previously. People who might embrace micro-credentialing and badging and the like from a de-schooling, breaking down the traditional elitisms of institutions, could well be at risk of collaborating with the enemy, because that language plays perfectly into the hands of the neoliberals who want to create a higher education marketplace. So this is very complex. I like to keep it simple. And so therefore, if you like, what we have are the forces that are telling us that education is in change and we must respond to change. In fact, it's in crisis. What we have is very few people talking about the need for education for change. What is the change that we're seeking, that we want for the future? Instead of being a future taker, someone else's future that's being presented to us, can we be future makers? And in so doing, also look out for the future fakers, if you like. Now, this is a very entangled, if you like, as I've put, entangled narratives here. It's not as simple at any stretch to how I've shown you it might look. But ultimately, the lesson here, and my last section is very short, just looking at the time, is that actually single visions produce worse illusions than double vision or many-headed monsters. What we really probably need, I think, is the ability to have, at minimal, double vision. Because sometimes the example I used about micro-credentialing could well be used to break down the kind of barriers to learners that first and families like me might have not ever aspired to getting a degree. But these things need to be seen with different lenses. It's complex, like most life. I'll be very quick in this last section. I'm not sure how we get on with questions, but I'm going to be here right through to the rest of the conference and after, so we'll see. You can come and talk to me if I run short, I think. So again, I'll just start with a framing quote that technological developments are unavoidably linked to broader social imaginaries. And in fact, our conversations fundamentally are actually about, and the two previous keynotes are fundamentally about, what constitutes the good society. Our view of the good society and how education might serve that good society. You'll see in the background to this slide that I've anchored a lot of my work around the Sustainable Development Goals. So as you know, most countries in the world have signed up to these goals. They may not live in your respective policies and countries or politicians' minds, but we've already conceptualized in many respects and set targets for what some of us might think could be the good society or humanity of the future. And there's a kind of challenging question there for you to think about and hopefully answer over the course of the next few days. I was taken by our first keynote, and remember, again, I like to make these links, we were challenged with what is the purpose of education to help children flourish. I paraphrase that accurately. In my own work, I kind of take it slightly more than just flourish for the individual, but flourish for both the individual and for the societal good. And so when I'm asked what the purpose of education is, I say simple, three C's: to develop critical thinkers, critical consumers, and critical citizens, anchored within what's known as the UNESCO pillars of learning, way back from the 1950s, learning to be, learning to know, learning to do, and learning to live together. And the last was always seen as the most important. Actually, I add a fifth pillar, which is learning to change and transform. Because if you don't change anything, you're just going to reproduce what we have. And education's been very good at that. So in some respects, a little extension of our first keynote, because I'm pretty confident that if we were to ask that the flourish concept with the individual extended to the societal good. But we mustn't lose sight of that, for me, as what really the purpose of education is. And so last example, I've probably only got about 3 minutes to finish up on here, is let me give you then what the European Commission is currently doing in the digital space. There's an action plan for digital education published earlier in the year, and we now have this DigiComp 2. It's gone through one iteration, I think it made even 2.1 now, as a framework. And who would challenge the idea that a digital society needs digitally competent citizens? So, you know, I've placed a strong emphasis on citizenship. So let me show you a little bit of this framework where the strong emphasis is on promoting more participation in society as an end of education. Again, who would challenge that? Here's the framework that now has been developed in 2.1, down to the point that it actually has 5 different areas and 21 different competencies, is it? Or, yeah, 21 different competencies. It's a well-developed framework if you haven't seen this previously. Except, what's wrong? Anyone note what's wrong? Time is against me, so I'll tell you rather than take questions. Two white male hands in a suit. So how far have we really come? I wonder. Has the thinking really changed that much? So when we're talking about future-proofing...
Who's telling the story?
What's... told and what's missing from the story. These are all the hallmarks for me of the kind of questions an educated person and a citizen might ask. So I deliberately embarrass, I guess, the commission and people associated with this project. I know that they're aware of how, you know, an infographic came out like this, but in today's age, for me, that's inexcusable. So, lesson 3, you can't just take something off the shelf and expect it to work because it looks good. And I'm not just talking about a framework here, I'm also talking about all of that snake oil that's being peddled as educational technology for language learning. So, conclusion? Not too bad. Final remarks. 3 points, I guess, just to kind of reiterate what I've shared with you so far. First, just be wary of the risks of future-proofing. Remember those quotes about the future and how we were going to future-proof ourselves? Blind visions are risky. Even vision itself, there's a school of thought that says vision is what you end with, not what you start with. Vision's the outcome, because there are examples in history, I won't name them because it would be insensitive of me to do so, but there are examples of history where leaders have had visions that have taken whole countries down a certain direction. Second point, when we're talking about new technology in education, it is most definitely not apolitical. And it is most definitely not on an independent trajectory. It's infused within different views of what we might have, and I've put and used the language of what we see as the good society at the end of the day. And then lastly, I've made a call for anchoring the work that we do, particularly, I guess, in your work in languages, and in my introduction and greeting in the Indigenous Māori language. Language is not a technical system, as we heard even yesterday. It is about who I am and my identity. And it's very important in an age of globalisation and other forces at work. Final, very final slide, I promise, to wrap all of this up, which is, I guess if there's a takeaway outside of my original one, then Cal should be in the service of big ideas, not as a big idea in itself. Don't lose sight of the big ideas. Thank you very much. And I think we're kind of right on time, so I apologies, no questions, but that's a little trick that keynotes do so they don't get caught out. But I'm going to be here to take questions and talk, so apologies for that.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Another one.
Unless you want to take a couple of moments.
No, I mean, you are here, you are around. Now we have a break, there's the dinner, you are around tomorrow, so please come and talk to Mark.
And he's on the panel.
And, yes. Of course, Mark is on our wraparound panel tomorrow afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.